When I turned up there, I had an NHS clothes on, NHS trainers, NHS pants. And when I turned up at that house, what they did, they turned around and they just showed me kindness. Do you know, we live in a wonderful country. They really look after you, yeah? And what they did, they helped me. And from there onwards, it started to become a leap pad or springboard into something. I can't read and write. So there used to be a lady come there, taught me to read and write. She encouraged me to do some GCSEs, encouraged me to do some teacher training, encouraged me to do some other stuff. See, that lady who encouraged me, I married her, and I've been married to her for over 20 years.
Amazing. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfall. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today we have an incredible guest called Andy. He's been delivering drug and alcohol intervention support programs since 2005. Andy's approach and past experiences mean that he can relate to the young people and they can relate to him. He talks about how his life of chaos was interrupted by the love and kindness of a stranger, and how living a life of bewilderment has turned into a life of purpose, and how he went from living on the streets, in and out of prisons, to a happy family life and delivering a message of hope to those people who need it most. Andy, thank you so much for coming on. This Is Powerful.
Thank you.
So on this journey, we always start at the beginning. So I'd love to know where you're from and how was your upbringing?
Right. So I originally come from Southend-on-Sea. Yeah. And a very loving home. Yeah. There was a lot of care. You know, I was always provided for, you know, shoes, clothes, pet lunch, kiss on the head, sent off to school. You know, that was me. That was my home. My father had passed away at a young age, but I don't really remember a great deal about that. I was about 2.5 years of age.
Okay.
I can remember, like, later, because he was a Scotsman, and he liked to drink, and he liked, you know, socialising, and he was a steel erector. So he was kind of like quite a loud kind of character, so my mum explained to me, you know. And I have two brothers. They're like stepbrothers from a previous marriage. So I had my older brothers, and where I say older brothers, they were like 16, 17 years of age. So they were a lot older than what I was. And mum suffered breakdowns. So mum kind of like, I think burying her first husband and then burying my dad only after a few years of marriage. I think there was a lot of stuff going on around for mum.
Yeah.
So I got passed around the family a lot. So I sort of like ended up with my auntie and my auntie Mary, my auntie Lil, my auntie Lizzie. And like I was always sort of, I didn't feel kind of like I fitted in anywhere. There was a couple of memories as I was growing up, like 6, 7, 8 years of age, kind of like at the gate. I used to wait at a gate quite a bit and like look up the road. And my kind of auntie, she lived in a cul-de-sac. So like any cars which come in or anyone who walked down, you had to come a certain way. There wasn't not any other way into the cul-de-sac. Yeah. And like I used to be out in the garden a lot, looking over the fence and kind of like looking. And like in some ways I had that experience. It's like I was kind of like being left in lots of different places. Now, my mum's family was very large. There was 11 of them. So I kind of got moved around quite a bit. And then gradually as life took on, mum came out of hospital a few times and kind of like got back into the swing again. But then other things would happen. My mum had a very short temper. She was kind of quite, as you're looking back, you know, you look back over time and you sort of see things as you have your own children and circumstances happen. You start to kind of look and see like, you know, there was some heavy. She was a lot older. She had had me late in life, like early 40s. Yeah, so it was quite, there was quite, yeah, there was quite a kind of like an age gap and all them kinds of things. And I never ever felt kind of like when mum would take me to school and stuff like that kind of thing. So I was always looking at mum was always a lot older than what the other parents seemed to be. I always felt like I was somebody kind of like not necessarily fitting in.
Yeah.
I kind of struggled in school. Yeah, I wasn't somebody who learnt very well, and especially around the kind of areas of like English and maths and kind of like, them normal kind of basic subjects that you get taught with in school and they home in on. I wasn't really fitted into that kind of understanding. I was the one who'd always drift off. I was the one who'd look away. I loved art. I loved drawing. I loved stuff like that kind of thing. And I loved to be able to create stuff.
Yeah.
So I was somebody, if you gave me a pair of scissors, you gave me something like that, paper, card, things like that, that's something that I would enjoy doing. And school was a struggle. There was a couple of teachers there, which I would say that I didn't really kind of like fit into their understanding maybe about behaviour and the way I was and kind of like kept being moved about certain areas and gradually we got to a place of where I went off into secondary school. And when I went into secondary school, mum didn't really sort of say kind of like this is where you're going or this is it. It was sort of like I picked the school. And like I picked the school for completely wrong reasons.
What was the reasons?
Well, there was a reputation. It was a school which kind of like had, it was an all-boys school. And it had kind of like, you know, that was the sort of school you went to. And I had started drifting towards an understanding of a bit of like antisocial behaviour. It was that area of a time when there was quite a large unemployment, a lot of music kind of around that, like there wasn't really much to do, or what's the point?
That was late 70s for you, wasn't it?
early 80s, and that's like where I suddenly just started to kind of like drift that way. And secondary school didn't really start off very well. Straight away, really. I'd already got myself into a situation of I would take solvents. The friends I grew up on my estate, we were a little bit into stealing cars. We were a little bit into antisocial behaviour, sitting under the street light playing cards, staying out late, you know, and them kinds of things. Going over areas where there's industrial estates or there was a bit of fields and stuff like that. And that was me, really. I sort of like to be out of where I was at home.
Makes sense, right? It's kind of probably like you found your own crew.
I would say sometimes I was probably the laughing joke. I would say in them situations, I was kind of like the one who would sort of jump in on something and really I would just sort of go along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nicknames. Yeah. Everything was a laugh. Everything was a joke. Yeah. Unkind. That's where I'd go with them kind of words. Unkind to each other.
Yeah.
Mickey taking. Making you feel belittled. Making you feel small. Yeah, that embarrassment, that kind of stuff like that. And in them teenage years, you're sort of like learning all your social skills and you're learning all about yourself. But there I was. I became something that I really was never meant to be. And I can clearly see that, because home, and there were circumstances, but there was love, there was people around, there was opportunities. But I just didn't kind of gravitate towards that. Yeah. I gravitated towards something else. And by the time that I got to that, like 13, 14 years of age, I was into blowing into the plastic bag. Yeah, and that was like solvents and Evo Stick and Fix-A-Fix and chemicals and kind of like just kind of PR sprays and stuff which you could buy from here and there, and lighter gas, stuff like that kind of thing. And like that was me, and like that's when situations started to happen.
Was that really about escaping?
I believe it was really more about being liked, being involved in something.
Okay.
It was kind of like the people that I was around, that's what they did. And it was kind of like, I can honestly think to myself, I didn't plan to do any. It's sort of like I just suddenly ended up in that situation of sitting in the ditch over the fields, blowing in the plastic bag. That's, you know, where only a few years before I would have been swinging on the rope swing and I would have been running through the cornfields.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like there was a switch, something went on, and kind of like, and once I started breathing in that stuff and things like that, it was kind of like I was in it, I was in that change. And then it quickly progressed from doing them kind of things to be doing it on my own.
Right.
It was kind of like that was something which went on a regular basis. And the first time it all come on top is when I came home and I had it all over my face and on my clothes. And I can remember, like, my mum actually in a state and all that kind of thing. Well, what's going on and what you're doing and all that, and ringing my brother and all them kinds of things, and everyone coming. And I've sort of, it's the first time I admitted that, you know, that's what I'd been doing.
How was that? It's quite a thing to be caught out, isn't it?
Yeah, they always knew I was a little bit of trouble in the school and things like that, but this is where this started to become more paramount. You know, well, that there was something going on, and when it started to go on, and then I was breathing, I was taking in them substances and all that, and then I got caught at school with lighter gas up my sleeve of my jacket and like in the class and all that, and then that's when I first got suspended. And things gradually materialised. I was always running that way. And then there was somebody in school, and I got to start getting into cars and into crime. Started being not any crime of anybody who was like just a hanger-oner, really.
Yeah.
Just getting in the back of cars, being arrested, maybe breaking in the odd factory, maybe having a look around in a fact, you know, stealing stuff, things like that. And what we started gravitating towards then is kind of like, it's that progression. And where I started gravitating to is that I felt like I would just steal stuff. So when I just felt that I was owed a penny.
Yeah.
And like, and I weren't prepared to do anything about it other than to steal, really. Now, mediocre, silly things. And breaking in stuff, and kind of like, you know, there was sometimes we found petty cash or other stuff and things like that. And nothing, you know, just young kid going from one place to the other who was caught up in that craziness, and then getting nicked, and then caught, and then appearing in court, and then appearing, and then prison, and then off.
And
on that journey.
Teenage years.
It's all teenage years, yeah. And then suddenly just kind of like suddenly in the situation where I never fitted into that. It was always a struggle. Being locked up, taken away, it's always a struggle. Didn't deal with that. But it was kind of like I was on a rebound. It was a little bit like a magnet. And I would kind of get myself back in that situation, and then I'd brush myself down and I'd think, right, I'm going to go for this, I'm going to have it. And school sort of collapsed. So I didn't get any education. Didn't kind of like read or write very well.
Yeah.
If someone put a form in front of me, I would become quite hot, sweaty, panicky. And then I would probably do something outrageous. Yeah, tear it up, throw it, you know, yeah. Argue, yeah. Because I didn't feel, I always felt like I was being exposed.
It's a good word.
Yeah, and that's how I felt all the time. I felt really
uncomfortable.
Because
that would have been like embarrassment and fucking anger and frustration, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and all that stuff started to happen.
Yeah.
Quickly in my life. And my mum was somebody who, it was always, you're not like your brothers. You don't measure up. Mm. Yeah, my brothers are very successful people. They've been, you know, in the city and everything. Yeah, successful. Yeah, they've done well. And they, you know, they're retired now, but they, you know what I mean? They've done really well for themselves. And I was always feeling like I'd never measured into things. So I, in some ways, I don't know if I had a self-destruct mode, but I sort of like dived right in at the chaotic kind of end.
Mm.
And
sounds like a form of survival mode. Actually.
Yes, yeah, survival, but also like I show you.
Mm.
There was a little bit of that going on as well, and I kind of. But before you is, it's like once it's out of the bag, you can't get it back in.
Mm.
It's like it's out now, isn't it? And you're in it, and like and the way that life was heading and. So I just got into lots and lots of chaotic situations. And then there was a couple of young people or my year group at school who were into smoking weed and sniffing amphetamine. And that I started to gravitise towards.
Was that speed?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I started to gravitise in. Alcohol wasn't really about... So I would go out at sort of like 16, 17, 18, and then we would go out to different places where we would get into or wherever we would go. And it was about drinking like water, orange juice, but sniffing powder.
Mm.
Yeah, and smoking stuff. And that was it. Yeah. Music was a big thing and all that and staying up.
Yeah.
And being up and going out and doing whatever you wanted to do. Yeah, that was me. And that progressed at a state of a rate, and there was a couple of people where we would do race tracks, pit stops. So you'd line up like lines of amphetamine, and you'd start sniffing that, and then you would have a little pit stop.
Right.
And then you'd sniff off the next bit, and you stop again, and you sniff a bit more, and then it come round, and it always stunk like cat's wee. It was always that pinky colour. And we used to get it off this gentleman, call him a gentleman, but he was kind of like quite a bit older than us, but he always seemed to have like lots of it.
Mm.
And, you know, and people start giving you bags and things start happening and, you know what I mean? And you're just off and running. And that was me. And it caused a lot of problem with my teeth. It caused a lot of problem with my bones.
Well, people grind. You grind that stuff, didn't you?
It caused a lot of kind of like... And I would even say I was starting to have some strange experiences. Then someone appeared with a syringe. Yeah, and kind of like circumstances. Do you know, I grew up with a generation of where it was like, you know, say no, don't get involved in this, don't do that. But the people I was with, they were a little bit older. It was always a little bit older, the people I was with. And I just started kind of like and gravitated in the next thing. I was starting to put a syringe in my arm and I was just a teenager.
Mm. Was that heroin or was you doing speed balls
and stuff? No, that was amphetamine, first of all. And then circumstances never worked. You know, that was not really...
Was you living at home still now? Or was you
I'd been asked to move on.
Yeah.
I used to go through the cupboards at home looking for stuff to steal.
Yeah.
So I would steal the odd thing here and there. And one day I found an envelope with 60 quid in it. And I'd stole the 60 quid. And I spent it on KFC, fruit machines, and weed and other substances.
Mm.
And it all went pretty quick. Because I had a lot of people hanging on. Like I was quite, I'm quite a kind, generous kind of person.
Mm.
Yeah, that was always the downfall. But now it's a great asset.
Yeah, yeah.
I really didn't understand all that about me. And I was somebody, so it all went. And when it went, I came home and my mum was there. And she kind of said to me, she said, did you steal the money? And I remember, I looked at her, she said, did you steal the money? And this was always me. Do you know? I never stole it. I wouldn't do that. And as I'm looking at you now, that's how I was.
Mm.
Yeah, I was in that position of it weren't me. You know, when as if you're a child and you're in a classroom and children are throwing things about and something happens and all that, and then Miss comes in the class and Miss says, who's done this? And everyone's going, it weren't me, Miss. I never did it, Miss. See, that was me. Yeah, it weren't me, Miss. I never did it.
Yeah.
But my auntie was a little bit different to what my mum was like. And my auntie said to me, you did steal it. You have nicked it. And mum's fed up with the police coming round the house. Mum's fed up with you going away. Mum's fed up with the school ringing up. Mum's fed up with the hospital. Mum's fed up with, look at her. She can't put up with all this anymore. And mum used to shake. Yeah. And she used to kind of get quite tearful, quite emotional. And it was all too much worry. And she would have a tissue in her hand. And she would always move the tissue around all the time in her hand. There was nerves and stuff like that going on. And where she at the hospital and other stuff. And my auntie said to me, you can't stay here no more. You can't stay here anymore. You can't live here. And then from them sets of circumstances, I remember it was only a few months before I'd been given a front door key. And when you're a young person, a front door key is quite a big moment, yeah? Because you can come and go and stuff like that. And you can be trusted.
Who's that for?
For me, the front door key was given to me by my mum.
Oh, by your mum, yeah.
But that episodes or things going on, eventually she turned around and said to me, you've got to give us the key back. You can't stay here no more. And I can remember that giving that key back. I never really ever had a key again after that, really to anywhere. A couple of bedsits, a couple of other places, girlfriend or friends that I've associated with, and someone might give me a key. But it was like I gave that back, and then I went and lived with my Auntie Mary. And Auntie Mary was completely a different kettle of fish. But Auntie Mary was also somebody where she would instill good values. She would instill values AE and around about. You can't go about stealing. Can't go around thieving. Yeah, she would really bang on about that stuff. And eventually what happened was that she went to Romania to help the orphans when the wall came down, Ceausescu and all that kind of stuff. And she went out there and did some work. And while she was there, I sold all her belongings in her house. And I can remember my brother coming round one time and he said to me, where's everything gone? And what happened with me? I never planned to do that. It's kind of one thing went, and then I got whatever I needed out of that. Then something else went.
So this was just to pay for the gear.
This is for drugs. Yeah. It was drugs. It was mainly drugs. My brother was really what are you doing? Yeah, he wasn't a brother who'd come in and weigh you in and all that. And then what are you doing? Start throwing you about and all that. He wasn't like that. He would just come in and he'd say, what are you doing? And then I said to him about the drugs and all that, and that's when he went off and he came with me and we brought some drugs and he paid for the drugs for me. And and so I was all right.
Yeah.
And then we went around all the shops and he started buying the stuff back.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
Right. And he brought the stuff back and eventually he was telling the shop what had happened and all that sort of stuff. And I was there with him and he explained it, and he got the stuff back.
Wow.
And he brought it back and all that. But the conditions were that I had to move on.
Yeah.
I couldn't stay there anymore. Auntie Mary was a big, big part of my life, really. She would always appear at places when I'd end up in hospitals and stuff like that. And that's when I started ODing.
Yeah.
Started kind of like, I'd got onto heroin. I'd got onto other substances and I would start to OD. I'd met a lovely girl. And she really tried to help me. And yeah. She was like the love of my kind of like school life, you know, and I sort of hit the jackpot.
Mm.
And I was sort of like, and you know, just over time, and then gradually we sort of shacked up together and all that sort of stuff. And but the same thing happened again.
Yeah.
Nicked all her rings, sold all her rings. As you say, I'm just a thief. Just a low-level bottom thief who's going from one disaster to the next. Mm. That was me.
Did you know it, though, at the time? Because it's easy to see in hindsight, but when you're in heavy addiction and you're addicted to the drug, you need to have it. Because at one point, for people who don't know, you cross the line, don't you, and you have to have something before you want it, but now you have to have it. Because otherwise you can literally die if you don't take stuff as well.
I got to the place very, very quickly where I knew I had a problem. Right, then I start making guest appearance at kind of like dip centres. They were kind of, there was a roach unit, and you would be able to get a substance which would help you, methadone, stuff like that.
Yeah. Was that just because you couldn't get what you needed at the time, or was there a little bit of trying to get help?
I would say I was always crying out for help.
Okay.
Always crying out for help. It wasn't like there wasn't a kind of like, this is what I was, I just knew I was in trouble. Yeah, I know that. I was caught up in what I was caught in. I wasn't doing crime things and I was affecting a lot of the community. Yeah, large extent in the community. Lots of things what I was getting up to, yeah, was impacting people. Yeah, and I might have not seen that straight on, but the aftermath of it. But you don't get that at that age because you haven't got anything to measure that on.
Yeah.
See, that comes within time. You start to learn stuff.
You usually have to experience something to have empathy with.
Well, that's course, it. Right? Yeah. And like, and I'm all about A&E. So I always speak with authority.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I can speak from that place.
Mm.
But I can also speak from a place of empathy.
Mm.
See, so A&E is a really good thing for me, and that sort of took me into that life where I was really a broken man, and I'd go from one disaster to the next, and eventually what happened, it ended up with me being on the street,
right,
and prison always in and out. And I got to know lots of people. So you'd walk in on the spur, you walk in on the wing, and you would know people straight away, and you would know people who would thing. And I had a couple of people who used to come and give me a visit, and I would have conversations with people, and like, you know, I just always sort of.
So you had
like
a life in and out
breezed,
by then?
Yeah, breezed in sort of ways, really. I was always. I'd fit in. I love playing football, love playing sport. So I was always sport in prison, stuff like that. On the football team, yeah, I always liked the things to do, as in with the gym orderly and all that. I was just that kind of person, working the kitchens. I'd find a job in the kitchens. I would adapt. Yeah. I'd adapt to something. Didn't enjoy prison. It was like when the gate opened, everything was euphoria because you're getting out. Of course it is. Yeah, and you're happy about all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also about where that was. So there was times when I'd get out on, say, like on a Thursday, and I could be back in prison on a Wednesday doing a completely new sentence.
Yeah.
Not understanding what the consequences is of my actions for other people.
Yeah.
Didn't get that. Didn't understand that until I started doing things like toe-to-toe. Started working in prison with courses and stuff like that, and I start to get an understanding about all that. See, there's lots of parts of my journey where I've been in lots of different institutions, section twice, mental health, secure units, hospitals, lockdown wards. And I would appear because of incidents which had happened.
Mm.
Yeah. Harming. Yeah. Stuff like that kind of thing. Yeah. And sometimes not intentionally, but sometimes intentionally.
Mm.
So when I would end up in hospital, then I would start to thaw out. And then after a while, you thaw out and you look around and like, and there's people running around half naked or naked. And there's like, you know, the trolley gets reeled out and everyone's all around the trolley and everyone's waiting for the pills to be given out. And then someone does something daft and the trolley gets thrown over. And then there's an argument and then there's, you know, and it just a chaotic, yeah? Staff doing the best they can do.
Did you have moments of clarity and understanding where you're at those points? Because it must be quite a realisation, because if you're coming off massive highs and you're on drugs and then you're having a moment of, how did I get here again? How was that?
Summoning in places was relief, yeah. And after a short time, sometimes you'd sleep in a ward. They'd put you in a ward and there was about four or five people in the ward. And it, obviously, yeah, some of the people in that ward, i.e. as myself, were going through some very severe mental health challenges.
Yeah.
So you would have some incidents go on, shall we say. Things would happen. With me, I didn't really start to notice things after probably about 4 or 5 days, starting thawing out a little bit, starting to come round a bit. Head was very mushy. Yeah, not really understanding. Hadn't been eating very well. Hadn't been looking after myself, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, secondly to that, when I was there, I was somebody who would, after a while, think, what am I doing here? So then I would try to talk to staff and things like that. And it was kind of like some staff were really quite helpful. Some staff were not so helpful. Also, secondly, on top of that as well, there was one incident where there was a man who was in there and he kept coming over to me. And when he came over to me, he would speak very kind of like, you couldn't understand what he was saying. He had obviously lost his understanding of his way of train of thought and stuff like that. And he used to say, do you want to see a picture of my mum? And then when he would say that, and then he would pull out a picture of the Queen.
Right.
And he would show me a picture of the Queen, and then he would wet himself. And then he would start shaking. And do you know? And like, and when I spoke to one of them, he had been in institutions for about 20 years.
Wow.
Alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol had done that to him. Yeah. And he'd been moved around from many, many places, and he was never going to leave the place. Do you know? And things like that, that's when stuff really started to go. And I can always remember that. And then I can remember coming out and being able to go. And then sometimes from them journeys, I ended up through kind of key workers, help, support, stuff like that. They would get me off to little like break places or day programs or support things like that. So I've always been someone who have had a lot of kindness.
Yeah.
A lot of good people around me showing me, and somebody with myself, I've always withheld information, yeah? My brain and what I've all come through has always been kind of like on the ball. See, I've got that mind which has got renewed, yeah? I've got something going on, yeah, where I'm living a life of abundance, joy, happiness, peace of mind and freedom. That's a lot better life than living a life of bewilderment, loneliness, isolation, fear, and vulnerability. You know when you get vulnerable, when you suddenly find yourself in situations and you think, "Well, I don't like this."
Yeah.
And it's gone. Like the horse has bolted. You're in it now. That's when it really starts to come. In them moments, there was moments when Mum took me back. Daft things would happen and circumstances. I never really tried to clean up until I got to about 21, 25, 29 and 33.
What happened to 33?
They were the clean-up moments. That's what started to happen. I made lots of guest appearances in lots of treatment centres, got lots of really valuable information. Anybody who goes to a treatment and they're in treatment, The most important thing is, yeah, it's never wasted.
Mm.
What you learn and what you understand in a day program, a drop-in program, a treatment center, whatever it is, that stuff is all real valuable. Valuable.
Mm.
Yeah, because what that does, when that moment comes, yeah, I always say when that moment comes, when that trumpet sounds in your life,
mm.
when that moment of clarity comes, something happens, you're in that position. And that happened in a railway station not far from here.
Was that at 33?
It was about 32 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what started to happen there was that there was a lady. And I used to sit in a railway station. And journeys go on. I'd met my partner and she had fallen pregnant with my son. And my son was born a drug addict. He was born addicted to heroin, to crack cocaine. Social services took him away at birth. And he went into care.
Hmm.
I was wanted for street robbery. I got arrested. I was in prison. Case collapsed. But while I was in prison, my partner went and scored some drugs and she died of an overdose. And when she died of the overdose, I didn't get a chance to go and kind of like do what I needed to do. And
yeah.
it was all just a bit of a blur, really. And then my son, do you know drug addiction, alcohol addiction, gambling addiction, whatever rocks your boat, yeah? It's a little bit like someone's got a rubber. And it's sort of like everything you hold dear to you starts to get rubbed away.
Yeah.
Starts to get taken out of your life. It gets erased. So how your values are, the way you think, the way you act, where your love is, where your kindness is, where people are, where support is, your sense of who you are and what you are. Anything you hold dear gets rubbed away.
Takes away everything.
And then it puts you in a place of vulnerability. So I've always wanted to be a father. I never had a father. I've always wanted to be a father.
Hmm.
There's something about me that I wanted to be a father. Yeah? And I wanted to cut that umbilical cord when my son was born. I didn't get that chance because it was emergency. He was 8 weeks premature. And he was taken to the special baby care unit. And then they would take him off of the drugs.
Yeah.
We took drugs that day of his birth in the disabled toilet. Karen OD'd and security at the door and all that chaos. Today my boy is being born. And they took him away and then caught up and then I'm away and then eventually what happens is that he's put into care. Karen takes an overdose, not deliberately, OD'd. She dies. I'm in prison. I come out of prison. And what happens from there onwards is a state of action which starts to happen. And I end up in a station. Or stations.
Mm.
Chaos. And then there was a lady called Janet. And Janet was this wonderful woman, a pensioner, used to come to the railway station. And she would show love and kindness. And when she showed that love and kindness, she'd come every day with cheese and ham rolls. And she called all the down and outs in the railway station her kings and queens because she had a heart about something. And this lady used to come all the time. And some days she'd talk to me. And when I speak to her, I would chat to her in such a way using different language to what I'm using now to clear off. But I always wanted her cheese and ham roll because I always was hungry.
Mm.
And she used to show me that kindness and talk to me. And she used to say, have you had enough, Andy? Have you had enough? And all the places I've been and all that. And she reminded me of my mum because I'd fallen out with my mum by that stage. yeah, how I show you and all that sort of stuff. And like, and I was just the shell of a person sitting at the bottom. You got 10 pence, mate, gets 50p. You got any spare change for the phone? Come, you got, can you get us a drink, mate?
Yeah.
You see them everywhere. See them this morning. They're everywhere. That was me. And then what turned around, a course of events through that kindness of that pensioner, that lady, she said to me, I might know some people who can help you. And that's when two young teenagers, or 20s, came in. And they came in, and I got into hospital, and they cleaned me up of all the drugs, which wasn't an easy process. But I started to clean up. I started to see things. You know, when you start looking in the mirror and you start to think like, who am I? Who is this person looking back? Because I'd forgotten myself. See, I'd looked in the mirror many times, but I'd moved away and I'd really lost who I really was.
How did you go into sobriety from that?
Right.
Place?
The launch pad was that I got myself involved in that house.
Yeah.
And that house took me in. And then when I turned up there, I had an NHS clothes on, NHS trainers, NHS pants. Yeah. And when I turned up at that house, what they did, they turned around and they just showed me kindness. Do you know, we live in a wonderful country. They really look after you, yeah? And what they did, they helped me. And from there onwards, it started to become a leap pad or springboard into something. I can't read and write. So there used to be a lady come there, taught me to read and write. She encouraged me to do some GCSEs, encouraged me to do some teacher training, encouraged me to do some other stuff. See, that lady who encouraged me, I married her, and I've been married to her for over 20 years.
Amazing.
See, the man who finds a wife finds a really good thing.
So she, you got married, so you've been sober for 22 years?
Coming up to 22, yes.
That's amazing. So she, so really, when you met your wife who helped you, you was just starting to get sober then?
Yeah. She kind of like brought me in and took a massive step of trust. And we met her, and I met her through faith in church and got involved in all that. And that springboarded me into other things. And what happened, there was a gentleman who came into that house as well by them people from prison. And he set up a charity. And he set a charity up about going into ballparks, Lewisham, Peckham, all over southeast London, into Kent. And he asked me to come along and be a part of that. And that's when I first started going in parks and talking to kids. Different cultures, different backgrounds, learned a lot. Went to lots of different schools, lots of different places, started working with picking people up from prison, started coming around and all that. And then somebody from a set of circumstances rang me from an organisation called the Kenwood Trust.
Which is a brilliant one because I went to visit it.
Yeah, and then said to me about, would you like to come and do some work with us. So, like, I've always fallen into things, or doors have opened, opportunities have arrived. Yeah, and they continuously do that. And then from there onwards, I kind of like was able to start to give something back because I was a client of Kenwood Trust. And then opportunities arose from being able to start to go into schools. And started to get more understanding and then eventually started to speak into young people.
And this is through the Kenwood Trust
Mainly through the gentleman I met originally.
Yep.
Through training, support and all that sort of stuff. And then it's gradually grown into what it is today, which is kind of like lots of opportunities of speaking to young people with assemblies to do with Think Differently. And what Think Differently is about is coming along and challenging young people at that part of their age with information to be able to steer them, to be able to start to make right choices. Now, not all young people are involved in drink, drugs, crime, antisocial behaviour.
Yeah.
But what this is about, we talk about how easy it is to be able. So we, in some ways, we are intervention. We come in. But then we also work with groups where the school have highlighted or they come to their attention. So we do smaller groups and workshops and then one-to-ones and then moving and operating in a one-to-one to be able to come alongside a young person to start to show their domino effect. Like a domino effect is something that kind of can work in both ways in your life.
Mm.
It's the choices you make. So I've been able to have lots of experience and kind of like, you know, just stuff has come, dropped into the train of thought and stuff. And I've made a box of lots of tools, which sort of takes up a lot of filing cabinets and a lot of other things. And when somebody asks about a certain area or a certain thing, yeah, I can go and take that.
Yeah.
Yeah, through life experiences. So I OD'd 4 times. So that's hospital. So that's intensive care, heart support machines, all that kind of stuff. Car accidents, turning upside down, skidding down the road, hitting the reservation, going down the side, being actually getting out of that and being able to walk away from them circumstances. Secondly, on top of that, what we're talking about is all the prison. And then knife crime, that stabbing and what it feels like when that's happened and how you feel around that and the panic and the social looking. Not, it wasn't social media then, it was papers and things. Yeah. And there's someone coming after, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And what's happened to that individual?
The amount you've learned from your life, good and bad, you now can put that into a great little program to help these kids from pure experience. So there's no questions because you've lived it.
Well, I've got all my criminal record. Yeah. Which is, you know, pathetic, useless criminal.
Mm.
But it's over the length of my arm.
Yeah.
And it's like front and back and in and out all the time. So when we go through them, when they say, well, what happened? And when I say, well, that's there. And it says what I was, you know, what I was in prison for.
Mm.
So you can start to break it down about what we were doing. My son's now 25 years of age, used to come and do talks with me. He comes along and chats and speaks about all that stuff as well.
Wow.
You know, it just goes on and on and on.
Powerful.
It's recovery.
Yeah.
Got invited to the palace, you know, went off to the palace in my suit, my only suit. Yeah, a few years ago and went along there and all what was done there about awards, about helping.
Do you feel warmed by stuff like that, or do you feel like this is still part of giving back?
This is only just starting.
Mm.
It's not about what I do. It's about who I am. See, there was a time when I was kind of, give me. Come on, give me what you got. Mm. Give me. Today I'm make me.
Mm.
Make me. Make me a tool of your kindness, tool of your love, so that I can go and do something today which would inspire somebody.
Mm.
I was recently at a project very recently, and like this young girl, she said that it's the first time she's came, and she was sitting there and she was speaking to me. And when she was speaking to me, what she was saying was like, you've really inspired me. And then she wrote me a card. And when she wrote me that card, she drew lovely love hearts on it and all that kind of thing. And she put it in an envelope and she gave it to me. And when I got in my car and I was about to leave, I opened that envelope up. And when I've opened that little envelope up and I've opened it up and it's the little love hearts and it says, thank you for inspiring me. And her name was Destiny.
Amazing.
Right? And we all have a destiny. We all have an opportunity.
Mm.
Life can turn around and things can start to change. I never thought I'd be sitting here talking to you. The rest of the week in my diary of opportunities and places that I'm going and things which are happening. So there's moments in your life where somebody comes in, speaks something happens, and there is an opportunity. She's not seen what's happened since then. She hasn't seen the thousands of young people the people wherever we've been able to encourage and support and help, and ongoing, you know, where you can speak case studies. I could sit here all day talking about young children and life turned around. Parents who are absolutely bewildered by what's been happening, but have suddenly got such hope. And don't always think it's the person and the family which may not be in a great position. I visit all types of people from all types of backgrounds. And you never really know when you ding dong on that doorbell who you're going to meet. And it's always nearly the mum who answers the door. And she says things like, "Oh, Tommy's." And we sit down at the kitchen table, we get a few things out, we start to have that conversation, and we start to bring about a bit of hope, not just for the young person, but for the whole of the family.
Thank you, Andy. We'll end on that. Thank you, mate.
Thank you very much, Paul.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefoot and at this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefoot. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.